yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Mars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Mars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and now ICE agents may be helping out the TSA to unclog the mess at many of America's airports, the mess made by the Democrat Party, which refuses to fund Department of Homeland Security. I know, it gets complicated. And then you had a terrible crash at LaGuardia Airport in New York City. And what happened was an airplane ran into a fire truck, and it now appears that air traffic control or ground traffic control, which had cleared that fire truck to go onto the runway, air traffic control may in fact be at fault, and we'll talk about that. It was a deadly crash for the pilot and the co-pilot, but basically everybody else on the plane managed to escape without serious injury. And here in the Northwest, it sounds like elected officials sold out their constituents to make a few bucks for themselves. Only the amount of money is a bit more than a few bucks. It turns out that Amazon paid Oregon officials and their company. This is according, and I'll give full credit to OregonLive.com. They paid them more than $100 million while looking to get a data center deal. Does it strike you that these data centers are turning out to be a real disaster, both for the Pacific Northwest, for electric power, and even for elected officials? Because if you put people in a position and you say, well, you could make a lot of money, all you've got to do is sell the tax breaks, and big companies like Amazon will pay you a lot of money. I think that's kind of a problem. Anyway, welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our poll on X. Today's question, should ICE agents assist TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? I would answer that one yes. I mean, you may or may not, if you haven't been paying attention the last couple of weeks, you may not be aware that we now have major airports in America that are actually threatened with being shut down. And why? Because TSA isn't getting paid. And as a result, a lot of people who used to work for TSA have now decided to turn in their notice and say, I no longer want to work here. So President Trump has announced that ICE agents will be sent to U.S. airports to assist the TSA with long security lines because of the ongoing Department of Homeland Security shutdown. Now, I think that's an appropriate use of federal resources. Send the ICE agents to the airports. Maybe they'll even find a few illegal aliens while they're at it. But should we use ICE agents to supplement what's not being done by TSA at America's airports? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, about this deal involving Amazon and data centers here in the Pacific Northwest. As you're aware, we've talked about the problem of data centers quite a bit. Those data centers may be associated with artificial intelligence. They may be associated with selling things on Amazon. They may be associated with social media, things like Truth Social or any of the others like X, formerly Twitter. So what happens when big companies say, we've got to get those data center deals put together? Well, according to OregonLive.com, and I will give full credit to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, Amazon paid more than $100 million to a tiny fiber optic company called Windwave Communication from 2019 through 2022, a period of about 3 years. They're paying them about $100 million. And why? Well, there were four local officials who bought Wind Wave from a local nonprofit organization the year before. And the four had all served on the nonprofit's board, and they all played a role, according to Oregon Live, in awarding tax breaks to Amazon that would have saved the tech company about $435 million. So in other words, the same kind of fraud that we're seeing in so many places in America right now, whether it involves Medicaid, Medicare, whether it involves data centers, Amazon spent $100 million legitimately, they say, buying internet services from that fiber optic business in rural Oregon, even while the tech giant, Amazon, was negotiating with some of the firm's owners. They were local public officials to get tax breaks and property acquisitions to buy a cluster of data centers in Morrow County. So think along the Columbia River out toward Pendleton. Following an investigation, the Oregon Department of Justice brought civil charges last year against eight people connected to Wind Wave Communications. Now, of course, Amazon says we didn't do anything wrong. We were just doing legitimate business. We had no idea that is what was going on. Now, the state says that insiders arranged to buy Wind Wave for about one third of its true value by hiding the value of its business with Amazon. If you don't know that Wind Wave was doing business with Amazon, then you don't know what the company's really worth. So it means you can go in, pick it up for a song, and then cut a deal. And Amazon finds a way to be able to put money in the pockets of people, allegedly, that were making the decision about whether or not they would get data center breaks and be able to establish those data centers in Morrow County. This kind of corruption just absolutely cannot stand. And we've got to make sure that we go after this kind of corruption, because otherwise there are too many opportunities in what is supposed to be the clean, green Pacific Northwest, where supposedly legitimate officials, they don't face much opposition, especially in Oregon, where you have single party control. So nobody's even watching the store because the Democrats run everything. The Democrats are the attorney general, the governor, the secretary of state, the state treasurer, two-thirds of the legislature in both chambers, and, of course, the governor's office as well. So if you say, well, the attorney general will keep an eye on that, the attorney general isn't going to do squat. This is the same attorney general's office, not the same attorney general, but the same attorney general's office that when Tina Kotek and the Democrat Party of Oregon got $500,000 in illegally contributed stolen crypto cash from FTX and that whole mess, that nobody brought any charges against anybody. That even though the money was given illegally, do you think the attorney general's office gave a damn? Of course not. They're run by the Democrat Party. If the Democrats own all the major offices, who is it that's actually going to guard the guardians in a case like that? In any case, glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls and to have you listening on the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X, should ICE agents help the TSA keep passengers flying at American airports? My answer to that is yes. You can find it at Lars Larson Show, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, maybe some of those reporters in the legacy media ought to get their ears and their eyes checked. I don't remember those reporters sounding the alarm when the cost of gasoline and diesel hit record highs under President Joe Autopen. That was 4 years ago when a gallon of regular topped $5 a gallon for no reason in particular. Well, now regular gas goes for almost $4 a gallon nationwide because of President Trump's justified attacks to stop a nuclear-armed Iran. Here in the Pacific Northwest, the effect is worse since the legacy media chooses to only focus on the price and not the question of why is that price the price. In Oregon, you have the low carbon fuel standard. In Washington, it's the carbon tax invented by Governor Jay Inslee. Both of them add substantially to every gallon of gasoline without any advantage for consumers at all. This would be a great time to explain why Northwest states pay artificially high fuel prices because of crazy environmental rules that the rest of the country, to a large extent, avoids. No such luck. Nor do we hear any commentary about refineries. There isn't a single oil refinery in Oregon. There are only a couple in Washington state. And in California, the number of refineries has been dropping for 34 years, with only 10 of them left in the state. And two of them, Phillips 66 and Valero, are shutting down very soon. But most of the stories, well, they just blame Trump for your pain at the pump. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. John writes in, Lars, so I was wondering if you've heard anything about a shooting at Prairie High School last week in Clark County. My caregiver, who takes care of my mother, her daughter was shot last week on or near the property of the high school. She is okay and not badly hurt. Seems to be either a pellet or maybe a non-lethal round, probably an airsoft. However, I've not heard anything about this on the news or anywhere else. Also, it doesn't seem the sheriff's office is taking it very seriously. Your thoughts, signed John. Well, John and I went back and forth by email a few times. I asked, has this even been reported to the police? Was the young lady actually shot? He says, well, she got a welt on her that may have come from a pellet, may have come from an airsoft. In any case, is the sheriff's department investigating? Apparently they are, but the school is also involved in that investigation. Although why schools are involved in investigations at all, I don't know. They have no expertise. They have no special knowledge, and the school should not get involved in what should be police investigations. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the Biden administration, who we like to refer to as President Autopen because Joe wasn't all there most of the 4 years, for shortchanging America's air traffic control system. And here's what I mean by that. There was a time during the Biden administration where they turned down literally thousands of young men and women who had taken the test and were qualified to begin the training to be air traffic controllers. And why did they refuse those groups of young men and women who were otherwise qualified? Because they weren't diverse enough. If you need a translation of that, there were not enough black, brown, gay, lesbian, transgender individuals, and so they rejected the entire list. So as a result, America is very short of air traffic controllers. If you listen to the tape, and I'm going to play some of it a bit later, of the young man who's doing air traffic control at LaGuardia Airport overnight, because on Sunday there was a terrible accident. He managed to tell an airplane to land on runway 4 at the same time that he had told a fire truck that it could cross runway 4. The airplane ran into the fire truck. Fortunately, there were 2 deaths, but fortunately no others. The people on the fire truck survived. The pilot and co-pilot did not survive. And it really seems that that air traffic controller was very, very heavily burdened as he was trying to control both ground traffic and air traffic control. A lot of this goes back to Joe Biden, and shame on him. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. John in Lakewood says, Lars, Just heard about the interview about how a lower court upheld the complete ban on semi-automatic rifles and shotguns in Washington. It angers me that crooked Democrats can use our money against us in the courts to attack our rights under the federal and state constitution. I remember when California made some rifles illegal around the same time that Charlton Heston was president of the NRA. I believe the state expected residents to turn those rifles in. Heston advised those people quietly disobey. Signed, John in Lakewood. To your calls, it's a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a possible solution for the TSA issue. You don't mind taking a page of the Democrat playbook. It won't put you in prison, do you?
If it works, sure. What do you want to do?
Well, I think it would take an executive order. But it would be to require all traffic taking off from airports to have to go through TSA, unless it's a single pilot and his family or something. And the second I'd add to that would be all Democrat politicians have to submit to a body cavity search.
I'll tell you what. Do you know one little game that members of Congress, and this may include some Republicans too, have been playing during this TSA slowdown? They get themselves walked to the head of the TSA line. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that needs to stop right now. And I don't care whether it adversely affects Republicans or Democrats. If you're a member of Congress, you can stand in line with everybody else. And I have a feeling...
Is that on YouTube?
I don't know if it's on YouTube, but the point is there right now, there have been in the last couple of weeks, there have been members of Congress who apparently go to the airport and they use their name and their title and they are walked to the head of the TSA line. They should be left to stand in line. And if they didn't show up 5 hours ahead of their flight and they missed their flight, too bad, then go back to Congress and vote to fund the TSA. And again, I don't care if those people are Republicans or Democrats. It's Monday, and you're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And I'm pleased to have with me Oregon Senator and GOP candidate for governor, Christine Drazen, Republican of Canby. Christine, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Good to be on today. How are you?
I'm doing well. There are so many things to talk about today. I do want to get to this issue involving camp counselors and that sort of thing, because this is the most important subject we've got. But there are a lot of things going on, and I want to know how the campaign for governor is going, because it's great to see Republicans have a rich field of candidates while the Democrats are stuck with Tina Kotek that even the unions don't want to recognize.
You know, I'm so grateful to be in the party of meritocracy. And I think that right now is what you're seeing in our Republican primary. We're all fighting to earn support and win over hearts and minds for the privilege of being able to lead our state. I think we all agree that this is a mess, that, you know, Tina's run our state into a ditch. And there's a lot of excitement and a lot of enthusiasm this election cycle. We came close last time. I want to finish the job. I want to get this done. But, you know, we have this opportunity in this primary to be able to make that case. And I'm just really excited about the response on the ground and the level of support, and just happy to be a part of this conversation, because we have got to do something.
Well,
we can't sit back. Whatever we did last time, we got to do more.
Yeah. Well, Christine, is there any point to demanding of the Democrats, if you think Tina Kotek has done such a lousy job, then why not replace her with a different candidate? Because they're not willing to do that. On the other hand, they're not willing, in many cases, the unions have said, we're not going to endorse her. They're just stuck with her. That's a real indictment of your own candidate when the typical Democrat supporters, the unions and all that, will not support her, but at the same time, the party won't replace her with something better.
Well, it's pathetic. It assumes that it's okay for us to be stuck in mediocrity, and it's so entitled for them to act like it doesn't matter who their candidate is. They don't have to be exceptional for the people of Oregon. Their candidate can be mediocre and poor at the job, and they think they'll still win, because if they thought that there was a chance that they couldn't win, they would replace her. So they're walking around saying, we don't care about outcomes for Oregonians. It's fine with us if we're worst in the nation in taxes and regulatory environment and safety and worst in the nation for housing affordability. It's okay with them as long as they hold on to power. So Oregonians are going to be the ones that are going to have to, you know, prove them wrong, that they have no business being entitled. They don't deserve to have a second term governor in Tina Kotek. And it would have been smart for them to replace her, but they chose not to. More than anything else, I just think they're so entitled. They just have to lose.
Well, and in fact, they've got the claim that was made by Tina Kotek. I will double the amount of housing construction that's going on in Oregon. And she not only hasn't doubled it, it has dropped dramatically since she took office. And a lot of it, you know, I mean, you might blame circumstances, but in her case, I think a lot of the things that are, that cause the drop are things that she encouraged her, you know, her own party to do. Raise taxes, all these other things. That's what caused the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just outlined it. She is a part of the problem. She's driven costs higher. She's made these projects not pencil for people that are out there that are in this industry. It's private sector that builds these homes, unless we're talking about actual public housing. It's private sector that's got to say, you know what, I can make a profit if I build this house or I build this neighborhood or I build this apartment. And too often it's her own slow permitting process. It's burdened by environmental regulations that have been heavy-handed for the last 40 years and taxes and labor costs that are just means that this stuff doesn't always pencil, especially stuff that first-time homebuyers can afford in a traditional marketplace. It's Oregon is out of line with the rest of the nation for costs, and that falls directly at Tina Kotek's feet.
I'm talking to Senator Christine Drazen, who's also running for governor. Tell me what we should make of this dad, Zach Hillegas, who told the Estacada School District, my daughter went to the outdoor school program, and she was roomed apparently with somebody who's a biological male who was there during, I guess they use bureaucratic terminology, an intimate hygiene activity. I'm guessing that means he was showering with the girls. What the heck is going on in the schools?
So that was horrifying and shocking, and I immediately called my Estacada school district because that's in my Senate district. That's my school. And I would say that Estacada is an incredible community. They don't put up with this kind of stuff. That's not Estacada's values. And so I called the school and talked to the superintendent, and he said that absolutely, that outdoor school provider is going to be fired. They're not going to continue their contract with that group. I don't think that that's been announced yet. I think that's going to come out from them on the other side of spring break. But this does not reflect the values of that district, which means that we have a contractor, an outdoor school provider, that wasn't communicating with the district, wasn't communicating with parents, and allowed for, you know, this issue to advance and absolutely betrayed the values of that district. Now, you know, obviously, the concern here is the girls. The concern is the girls. We have got to protect private spaces for women and girls. And this particular outdoor school provider refused to prioritize that. So it's a problem. Estacada School District is going to deal with it. It's incredibly important that parents like those stand up and speak out. And that is how we're going to get change in that district.
Now, I want to ask you about one other thing before you go, and that is the issue of the I-5 bridge. That thing seems like a gigantic train wreck, and it's going to roll right over taxpayers in the same way that Abernathy Bridge did. Is it time to pull the plug on the whole thing because it's so fatally flawed that it can't be done, and it can't be done for any kind of reasonable price? Or are you ready, would you be ready as governor to go ahead with it?
I'm not going ahead with it as it's been currently priced out. We're talking about 50% of that surface area being dedicated to light rail, bike, and ped. This is an interstate. There's no other place, along our interstate that we're saying, hey, we would really like to encourage people to walk by the side of this interstate highway. We'd really like to encourage people to bike ride on an interstate highway. They're treating it like a Portland City street. I think we can afford a bridge that is an interstate bridge, that is not bells and whistles, that is not a political climate agenda, but is a bridge that transports people. The current bridge, as proposed, is beyond ridiculous for scope and cost, and it is not going to advance as it is currently drafted under my administration.
Good, because I think somebody new needs to take that project over. It sounds like Greg Johnson realized the writing was on the wall. Senator Drazen, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. That is Senator Christine Drazen. She is running for governor of the state of Oregon, as well as serving as an Oregon state senator. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
National, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. A deadly runway collision at LaGuardia Airport has killed two pilots, injured dozens of people, and shut down for a time one of the busiest airports in the country. Does President Autopen, Joe Biden, does he deserve some of the blame? I'm going to make the case for that. This was absolutely stunning. This happened on Sunday night. Two people died, the two pilots on board an Air Canada Express jet, because as it was landing on the runway at LaGuardia Airport, it ran into a fire truck. Now, you might say, well, hold on. How does an airplane end up running into a fire truck? Let me tell you what happened, because they've already released the audio of the air traffic controller, who's both talking to the airplanes in the air. He's also talking to airplanes that are on the ground getting ready to take off. And he's talking to ground traffic like the fire department. Now, in this first soundbite, the air traffic controller in question is asked by the fire truck, the fire rig, do I have permission to cross runway 4? And he confirms, yes, you do. Take a listen.
Was the vehicle needed to cross the runway?
Truck 1 and Company, LaGuardia Tower.
Truck 1 and Company.
Truck 1 and Company, LaGuardia Tower, requesting to cross 4 at Delta.
Truck 1 and Company, cross 4 at Delta.
Truck 1 and Company, 4 at Delta.
Now, that's what happened. The truck company, meaning the fire rig, was asking permission from air traffic control. Do I have permission to cross runway number 4 at Delta? That would be D, where they cross runway 4. The air traffic controller takes a moment and then says, yes, you have permission to cross at Delta, and gives the confirmation. And then the fire engine comes back and confirms the instructions as they understood them. Now, that should be a fairly clear-cut communication. Guess what happened next? The air traffic controller realized just seconds later that he had made a colossal error in clearing that fire truck to cross runway 4. This is what it sounded like.
Frontier 4195, just stop there, please. Stop. Stop, truck one, stop.
Now, stop. Truck 4195, stop. He's telling them, stop, I've made a big mistake. In fact, there appears to be, on some of the audio, the air traffic controller admitting that he made a colossal error. He cleared the truck, the fire truck, to cross that runway at the same time that the Air Canada Express jet was on its way to land, coming in well above 100 miles an hour, which is the speed at which those planes land. So think about this. It's happening at night. If you're going, say, 120 or 130 miles an hour, that is about 2 miles every minute. It's a mile every 30 seconds. In the dark, do you think the pilot of the Air Canada plane can see 2 miles ahead of him? Can he see the fire engine that is about to cross runway number 4? He can't. Can the fire engine, by looking up in the sky, see the airplane that might be a mile and a half or 2 miles out? He can't see that either, which means the collision that happened took the lives of both the pilot and the co-pilot, but thankfully, nobody else on board that Air Canada Express jet. But I'm going to tell you why I think that President Otto Penn, and that is Joe Biden, bears a huge amount of the responsibility for this. During the 4 years of Joe Biden, they pushed diversity, equity, and inclusion very, very hard. And one of the things they did, and we talked about it on this program, was the FAA has a program whereby it clears people to be qualified to go into training as air traffic controllers. They had thousands of people who'd been cleared to go into training as air traffic controllers because the entire system is short of air traffic controllers. Now, what happened? Well, the Biden administration noticed that of the people cleared who had taken the tests and shown that they had the capability to become air traffic controllers, a huge number of them were both male and they had white skin, which means that from the point of view of liberal knuckleheads like Joe Biden, they're not diverse enough. In other words, not diverse enough is code language for saying, yeah, you've got a bunch of people who are qualified to become air traffic controllers. They're too white. There are too many guys. There aren't enough black people, brown people. There aren't enough women. There aren't enough people who are gay. There aren't enough people who are lesbian. There aren't enough people who are trans. And they wiped out the lists and said, we're going to go back and start over and qualify people who are a more diverse crowd. What did that do? It meant that you were taking people who were less qualified to do the job, number one. Number two, it meant that you were going to slow down the entry of more people into the field of air traffic control. It's already a tough job. It's already a stressful job. It's already a job that takes a special set of skills that not everyone has. I mean, I think I'm fairly capable, but I would never say that I would make a great air traffic controller. I think that it takes a special set of skills. And the Biden administration decided it doesn't matter what kind of skills you need. What matters is whether or not we provide a diverse workforce. And if we're not going to provide a diverse workforce, if we don't have the magic number of black, of white, of male, of female, of gay, of straight, of lesbian, of transgender, if you don't have the right rainbow of people doing the jobs, then you go back, you throw that list out, and you start over again. And even if it ends up getting some people killed, if you notice that the young man who was working air traffic control, whose voice you hear on those radio transmissions, he's the guy who's got to talk to all those airplanes and pilots. He's the guy who's got to watch 16 different things at once. And I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that it's an easy job to do. But when you overstress those people, if you think back to some of the things that played into that terrible crash where an Army helicopter ran into a civilian airplane near Washington, D.C. International, and what did we find about the staffing of the control tower that night? They had very thin staffing because they're short of air traffic controllers. And for that, we can thank President Otto Penn, Joe Biden, now sitting on the beach in Delaware, enjoying his presidential pension. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
So, in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I hope you won't think me less Christian than I am. But the fact is, I'm celebrating because the world's most prolific serial killer has died behind bars today. And when I saw that news, I thought, I don't often celebrate when somebody passes away. I mean, even people I disagree with in a huge way. But when it comes to the worst serial killer, the most prolific single killer of women and babies in the world. And I think I can say that. I think there was and has been nobody more prolific than Kermit Gosnell. I think that is worth celebrating. Anne McElhaney joins me now because Anne knows this story very, very well. She and her significant other, Phelan McAleer, are founders of the Unreported Stories Society and the authors, most notably, of Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. Anne, welcome back to the program. It's been a while since we've talked, but I think this was an appropriate end for Kermit Gosnell, was it not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's extraordinary news. I think there'll be a lot of people celebrating. I'm getting all kinds of messages from all kinds of people today. And we just talked to Detective Jim Wood, who obviously put him behind bars and who's, you know, who's very happy that, you know, he won't kill anyone else. You know, that possibility is gone forever, which is something marvelous. And just thinking about what he did, you know, maybe your listeners remember Kermit Gosnell, who ran this, you know, abortion clinic, inverted commas, by the way, in West Philadelphia, which was a charnel house, where he basically drugged these women up. They delivered babies that were alive, and then he cut their necks with scissors. And according to the grand jury, he probably did that to thousands of babies. He only went to prison for 3 counts of murder and obviously got 3 life sentences. But it was a lot more than that. And it's just an extraordinary, I kind of had forgotten about him, and then to find this out is amazing.
Well, I think it's amazing too, Anne, because I can't count the number of times that you and Phelan McAleer and I have talked about this guy. And one of the biggest, I guess, enduring mysteries for me is that to a large extent, if you mentioned Ted Bundy to somebody, or if you mentioned, Ted Kaczynski to someone, if you mentioned any one of the lesser serial killers of the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, people would say, oh, I know who that is. And then you say, yes. Kermit Gosnell. Is there a reason that Americans simply, for the most part, don't know this guy's name at all?
Yeah, and the reason is that the mainstream media chose and admitted it. By the way, they admitted, we have a whole chapter in our book about it, they admitted that they didn't want to give any kind of attention to this guy because they didn't want anything negative said about abortion. I mean, famously, the Washington Post, Sarah Cliff, was challenged by Molly Hemingway, you know, because Molly Hemingway was writing on Twitter and back in the day and saying, why aren't you writing about this? And famously, Sarah Cliff said, oh, we don't do local stories. Well, that's funny because I thought Trayvon Martin was a local story. I thought George Floyd was a local story. I mean, you know, we're local story. They love local stories. They adore local stories. And in fact, days after that exchange on Twitter, the editor of the Washington Post had to come out and apologize and say, we do actually cover a local, you know, and this is an incredibly important story. And it's important for so many reasons, you know, not least of which, by the way, the fact that the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, who really should have gone to prison themselves, let's be really honest about it, for 17 years, they didn't inspect the clinic. 2 women died. Samika Shaw died in 2000. And in 2009, Karnamaya Monger died, a Bhutanese refugee. I mean, this is who the left are supposed to love, right? This yep. Bhutanese refugee. She's in America for 4 months, by the way. Like, you know, finally she got to the promised land after being in a refugee camp for 20 years. Finally she arrives, only to die from being drugged to death by untrained staff that Gosnell had worked for them. And I always think about her, by the way, when you think about how demonic Kermit Gosnell was. The scene of her dying, She didn't speak English. You can imagine how terrified she was. She ends up in this clinic. It's dirty. It's filthy. He's not even there. And she starts to think, I'm in trouble. You know the way you'd get a sense in yourself? You'd think,
yep.
God, I'm in serious trouble right now. So she starts to get really agitated. They phone Gosnell and say, she's getting very agitated. And he said famously, drug her up.
Wow.
And they did, and she died. And I just think it was just, it's a terrible, terrible story. And the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, you know, I mean, really should have actually had to answer in a court of law for what they did, for the criminal neglect that they showed to the people who ended up in that place. 17 years they didn't cross the threshold. They didn't care that Samika Shaw died. She was in her early 20s, an African-American mother. They didn't care. They didn't care about Carnamaya Munger. They didn't care. There was one doctor, by the way, who complained that his patients were coming back after being to the clinic and they had STDs that they had gotten from being in the clinic, which was so dirty and disgusting. And they were reusing instruments, and that's how these people got these STDs. And he went and he actually, and I remember his testimony in the grand jury, he hand-delivered a complaint. He hand-delivered it to the Department of Health. And still, they did nothing. So these are despicable people, but the most despicable of all is the man who was perpetrating these evil crimes.
And that's Kermit Gosnell. And by the way, for people to say, well, but you have a different position on abortion. You can have whatever position you want on abortion. I happen to be pro-life. But if you've said the minute it involves abortion, even it involves the kind of criminal activity toward women that Kermit Gosnell did to women, and say, well, but because it somehow involved abortion, nobody is allowed to say anything negative about what happened or what Gosnell did because he did abortions. He murdered babies, and that was what the grand jury found. He took little babies and took a pair of surgical shears and cut their spinal cords. That's what they decided. Well, he has now passed away. The people who I think did the best job in documenting all of Kermit Gosnell's thousands of crimes, Ann McElhaney, Ann, thank you very much, and Phelim McAleer, founders of the Unreported Stories Society and the authors of Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. I'd ask you to do this test. When you watch the mainstream media over the next couple of days, you would think if there were a serial killer in America who had just died behind bars after committing thousands of murders, would you expect that that would merit some kind of mention on national news? And then ask yourself this, a day or two or three from now, ask yourself if you've heard ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, MSNBC or MSDNC, have you heard any of them even mention Kermit Gosnell? And if they don't, then you have to ask yourself this, are they capable of simply keeping the secret of the worst serial killer on planet Earth simply because he did his serial killing from an abortion clinic that was a clinic of horrors that Philadelphia didn't even bother to look at for 17 years. Back in a moment. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. With everything.
Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about an idea called a public charge. Now, public charge sounds something a little bit odd. No, it's not talking about charging on horseback or anything like that, nor charging with a charge card. No, I'm talking about the people who come to America and intend to stay here and the people who end up on the dole. They are basically living on the dole. And let me get into the numbers of that, because there's some fascinating new numbers when it comes to people coming to America and ending up on the dole. Anyway, if you want to join the best conversation in dog journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X today, should ICE agents assist the TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? I would answer that one yes. Donald Trump has announced that ICE agents will soon be sent to U.S. airports to assist the TSA with long security lines amid the ongoing Department of Homeland Security shutdown. By the way, that shutdown voted for by the Democrats. The Democrats decided we need to shut down Department of Homeland Security. Now, why are they doing that? They're angry about ICE. They don't want to see America's immigration laws enforced. And you say, well, does shutting down DHS shut down the funding for ICE? And the answer is no. And if your next logical question is, then what are the Democrats trying to do? If they've decided to defund the Department of Homeland Security, but defunding Homeland Security does not defund ICE, then what are they doing? You know what they're doing? They are torturing Americans. They're essentially holding everybody who has to fly hostage. Now, how many people fly every day in America? The number's kind of stunning. I mean, I don't fly nearly as much as I used to. I used to fly a lot more for work than I do today. I mean, having to fly off to D.C. or down to Los Angeles or off to New York or various other places, I don't do nearly as much of that anymore. But Americans, about 1% of the entire American population flies on an airplane every single day. It's about 3 million people a day. We have just over 300 million people who live in the country. So it's just a hair below 1% of the entire population that gets on an airplane every single day. So what's happening at the airports now? We have a gigantic number of people from TSA who have decided not to show up. They have called in sick, and they have said, I'm not going to show up to work. I'm not getting paid. Now, there are a number of people who are still showing up to work, and they know that eventually they will get paid. Whether they get paid in a week or a month or a couple of months, we don't know, because the Democrats are not telling the public, how long do you plan to keep this shutdown going? But in the meantime, Donald Trump's idea for solving it short term is send the ICE agents down to the airport. And, you know, I think this could actually have a couple of different advantages. Number one, there are going to be some illegal aliens who are flying from point A to point B in America, even with those requirements for real ID. And I imagine the next complaint you're going to hear from the Democrats is, why, all the illegal aliens are now afraid to fly. Well, they should be afraid to fly. If they don't have picture ID that actually depicts who they really are, they're not going to get on an airplane. And if you're afraid to go to the airport because ICE agents are going to be there, you probably shouldn't be getting on a plane at all. Anyway, you can find the poll on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to this, though. There's a brand new study out from the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS, I have found over the last couple of decades to be a very reliable source of information. Now listen closely, because this one will blow your doors off. You understand that in America, about 70 years ago, the United States Congress wrote rules for how people are allowed to come into the United States and emigrate here. We allow more than a million people every year to emigrate, and one of the requirements is you have to show that you are unlikely to become a public charge. Now, what is a public charge? That means you're unlikely to end up as a welfare case. You're not going to end up on food stamps, on Section 8. You're not going to end up on Medicaid. You're not going to end up in public housing. You're not going to end up being a deadbeat. That's one of the requirements to qualify to emigrate to the United States. Well, what does CIS find out? Non-citizens get welfare at double the rate of Americans. And you say, well, that's just racist. No, it's not. In fact, it doesn't really have anything to do with the race. Non-citizens, meaning if you are not a citizen of the United States, you may be a citizen of Canada, you may be a citizen of Vietnam, you might be a citizen of Russia or China, you might be a citizen of Australia, you might be a citizen from the Middle East, But if you're a non-citizen, non-citizens are welfare cases at double the rate of Americans. Americans are on welfare about half as often. 28% of U.S.-born households use traditional welfare. So what's the rate for people from Central America? 64%, well over double. From the Caribbean, 58%, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. South America, 43%. From the Middle East, it's not as bad, but it's still 46%. From Eastern Asia, 33%. Now, by country, the non-citizen households with the highest welfare rates. You ready for this? Afghanistan, 87% welfare. Dominican Republic, 78% welfare. Guatemala, 77%. More than three quarters of all the people from Guatemala are on welfare. El Salvador, 75. Honduras, 75. Ecuador, 70. Mexico, 67%. Haiti, 65%. The people from Cuba, almost two-thirds of them who come to the United States, and Cubans, by reputation, have a very hard-working ethic, a work ethic that just won't quit, and yet that almost two-thirds of them end up on welfare. From Vietnam, 57%, and from Venezuela, 51%. So imagine this. If you say, well, you're just disparaging people and you're being racist because you're talking about them being welfare cases. Yes, about one quarter of U.S.-born households use some kind of traditional welfare. They've got food stamps. They've got TANF, or temporary aid to needy families. They've got Section 8 housing, or they've got Medicaid. But when it comes to non-citizens, they're getting welfare at double the rate of most Americans. It is crazy. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Well, President Trump just quietly overhauled America's entire approach to addiction. Is addiction the disease that deserves some kind of medical treatment, or is it a choice that demands personal accountability? I thought we'd talk about it with Michelle Steeve, who's founder of the Free Up Foundation and author of Answers Behind the Red Door. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be with you.
One of the things that's frustrating,
especially.
Yeah, well, on this topic especially, because I put a lot of the blame on President Obama, because about 13 or 14 years ago, he announced that he was going to solve the problem of homelessness by going after addiction, but he was going to do it with housing first, and then the addiction treatment was going to come somewhere down the line. And not only did it not solve the problem's about twice as big today as it was 13 years ago when Obama made that promise, but I think he put the country on the wrong kind of path, because he told cities, you're not going to get any HUD money unless you do housing first, treatment whenever it happens. And that seems like a bad way to approach it. What's your perspective on how we deal with this problem?
Well, you are so right on so many levels. And let me just say, not only did it not end homelessness in a decade, which is what the president promised, the president at the time, but it's up almost 35%. And what he didn't talk about, it wasn't necessarily housing first, treatment, you know, later down the road. They actually defunded treatment services, mental health, and drug and alcohol counseling when they rolled out housing first as a one-size-fits-all approach to homelessness. They defunded those services, and they said that they were completely, even if people wanted those services, they were completely optional. And so there wasn't funding for those services, and the people people are so sick that are dealing with addiction and mental illness they often also have a disease called anosognosia that is layered on top of the diseases of addiction and mental illness. These are all brain diseases.
Anosognosia? Am I saying that the right way? Okay.
You are, and it is a deficit of self-awareness. So what that means is these people don't know, often they don't know how sick they are. And so, you know, when people say to me, well, it's this lifestyle choice, you know, in a small handful of cases, it could be, though I have some other arguments we can talk about later in the show. These people really don't understand the depths of their illnesses. And so the whole notion that they will voluntarily, once they get into housing, request these services, it's just crazy. It didn't happen. We all knew, those of us that served on the front lines for decades, like myself, we all knew this would be a disaster, but it has been an even way bigger disaster than we even thought it would be. And thank God President Trump and his administration, within you know, a year of taking office, issued this EO. It got very little media attention, but it's a really profound shift in how we treat addiction, and which plagues about 80% of the homeless population, but it plagues 48 million Americans across the country. It is now going to be treated under this EO that, you know, Secretary Kennedy is leading with Secretary Burgum's wife, both of whom have, you know, addiction, personal backgrounds in addiction, meaning they have lived experience, if you will. But we're no longer going to be treating this as a lifestyle choice. We're going to be treating it as a medical issue. It's a disease of the brain, and it should be treated as such.
I'm talking to Michelle Steeb, who's founder of the Free Up Foundation. So do we have the guts to actually say to people, here's the carrot, you can have housing, but you've got to get into treatment? If you're not willing to do that, then you're going to fall to enforcement of the law. But will American cities actually hold to that hard line?
Well, President Trump is saying, and now I will say the homeless industrial complex is fighting him. They've taken their battle to the courts, which is, you know, commonplace under the Trump administration. Anything he wants to do, right? It always seems to go to the courts. And they're fighting these reforms. But what President Trump is saying is, if you want, you know, federal government's the largest source of funding for homelessness. If you want our money, local city or local county, you need to be doing treatment along with, you know, interim housing. We don't need to be giving people lifelong housing, which was the policy under President Obama. We need to be giving them interim housing with treatment so that they can eventually recover and be able to afford housing on their own through work and being able to manage their diseases.
Well, and in fact, I'd like to see them take a greater responsibility for the disease of addiction. If you want to call it a disease, fine. But the fact is, you could burn up hundreds of thousands of dollars unsuccessfully treating a single individual for addiction. We've got to find an inexpensive or less expensive way, let's put it, to get people off these drugs, because otherwise at $25,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 a throw, times four or five times on each person to try addiction treatment, and then it fails, because even the treatment people say it's maybe successful 25% of the time. You know, we don't have all the money in America to treat everybody who's addicted to drugs, if that's the way we have to solve it, do we?
No, you're very right. Now, I will say I ran a program for homeless mothers and children, the largest in Northern California, for nearly 15 years. And we got our expenses down. We were a very comprehensive program, provided treatment, mental health and drug and alcohol treatment, employment training. We were able to get someone from crisis to being self-sustaining for about $20,000 a year.
Wow.
It is possible. We need to do it in a much more, as you pointed out, cost-effective but also effective way. And rehabs, you know, there's lots of different rehabs. They're not always the most cost-effective way, and you've got the insurance factor in there. Lots of layers of complexity, but this can be done in a very efficient and cost-effective way, and that's the direction the president is pointing us to. It's transitional housing coupled with these services to help people recover and be restored and achieve their best lives.
Absolutely. That's Michelle Steeb. Michelle is the founder of the Free Up Foundation. Michelle, I appreciate it. She's also author of the book called Answers Behind the Red Door. The fact is, there are an awful lot of cities in America that are run by liberal Democrats, and they will say, no, we're not going to insist that people get treatment. We're only going to give them free housing with your money. That approach has to stop. That approach is killing people. That approach is a waste of time and money. Back in a moment. Should your vote still count on Election Day if your ballot doesn't arrive by election?
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's a day in which the U.S. Supreme Court has heard a case involving vote by mail. Except it is the first time that I've ever seen an organization, in this case, a Seattle Times, this is a newspaper allegedly, but they sent out a release just a couple of minutes ago, literally 7 minutes ago. Mail by vote in Washington at risk in U.S. Supreme Court case. And I thought, hold on a second. Are they talking like Yoda? It's vote by mail. That's the way you call it, because we're not doing mail by votes. We're doing voting by mail. But for some reason, the Seattle Times actually wrote this up. Headline, mail by vote in Washington at risk, mail by vote at risk in U.S. Supreme Court case. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case that could end the practice of counting ballots received after Election Day, which could upend Washington State's mail-in voting system. It could do the same kind of thing to the state of Oregon as well. And why is that? Because there are a number of cases, states, in which there are 13 other states in which they count the ballots even though they arrive after Election Day. And that makes no sense at all. Again, I'm still trying to make sense of the Seattle Times fish wrappers headline, mail by vote in Washington at risk. Maybe they have a Yoda on the assignment desk. Maybe they've got an intern. Maybe their illegal alien who writes headlines for the Seattle Times has been drinking this afternoon. I don't know what it is, but they're calling it mail by vote instead of vote by mail. And this is not something somebody scratched down on a piece of paper. This is on their little service in which if you sign up for the Seattle Times headline service, which I am, they will send you a little set of headlines of the latest breaking news. And their latest breaking news is mail by vote in Washington at risk in the U.S. Supreme Court case. Let me tell you why this is so important, though. And I want to get to your phone calls and emails, too. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. If you're ready to be done with being a landlord, my Rocket listing lets you sell your property guaranteed, even if you have non-paying rent tenants in that property. Just go to NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com for all the details. Our poll on X today. Should ICE agents assist TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? I would say yes. I think it's a great use of ICE agents, and I think it'll be shocking to all the liberals to see ICE agents actually doing it, although I've had a number of emails from people who are very dismissive of the idea. They don't at all like the idea of ICE agents actually being supplemented or TSA being supplemented by ICE agents. They seem to believe that only ICE agents are capable of screening somebody and telling whether or not they're getting on an airplane with contraband or not. But that's the way they're reacting to the news. I think it's actually a terrific idea. Apparently, ICE showed up at the Atlanta airport, and already the backlog has been done away with. They got rid of all the backlog, and now they've got people who are getting on planes and flying where they need to fly. But let me go back to what the Supreme Court heard about today, because they heard the arguments from states that say, well, we have to be able to count people's votes way after Election Day. 13 states have said we have to be able to count them. Now, let me ask you this. If you happen to live in a vote-by-mail state, I have the advantage, I guess, of living in a vote-by-mail state. I live in the state of Washington. So I get a ballot 3 weeks before Election Day. Now, at any time during those 3 weeks, I can mark the ballot, put a stamp on it, drop it in the mail without putting out much effort at all, and I have voted. Now, if you don't want to do it that way, and I typically don't do it that way, I wait until Election Day. And then my wife and I both mark our ballots. I jump in the pickup truck and I drive the ballots to the elections headquarters and drop them into their collection box. I think that is more secure. Now, you can think whatever you like. The point is, I get it there by Election Day. That means it can be counted on Election Day. There are states, 14 of them, that allow late arriving ballots to be counted. So you're counting ballots 5 and 6 days after Election Day. Number one, I think that violates federal law, because the U.S. Constitution spells out, especially when it comes to the presidential election, it spells out the day on which Election Day occurs. It is the first Tuesday that follows a Monday in November every 4th year. That's when the presidential election is held. And if you say, no, we want to be able to send the ballots out, leave them out in the wind for 3 weeks, and then if people get them in within, say, a week of Election Day, that's close enough. Well, it sounds like the Supreme Court justices are a bit skeptical about whether or not they're going to buy that kind of logic. I hope they throw it out. And if it hurts Oregon and Washington, so be it. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, yeah, I was wondering about that IP-28, I think it is.
The one that would ban all fishing, hunting, farming, ranching, anything involving animals and the death of animals. Yep,
right.
It's probably going to make the ballot. I would hope it won't pass.
Crazy. I hope it don't either, but I was thinking when I was a kid, I'm in my late 50s now, and I'd go for like camping with my grandparents, and they had a fifth wheel. And I'd want to ride in the fifth wheel when we're going somewhere, but I guess that's against the law. You can't do that.
Nope.
Because it'd put me at risk. So I'm wondering, if you got a horse trailer, I don't have any livestock myself, but would you be able to haul a horse in a trailer, or are you putting the horse at risk?
No, you'd be able to haul all IP-28 speaks to specifically. I understand the point you're making, but all it speaks to specifically is, are you going out and killing or harming an animal without cause? So you can still kill in self-defense if a cougar comes at you or if a bear comes at you. You can still put an animal down that has gotten to the end of its life, but it would end all fishing, all farming, all hunting, all animal husbandry. It would end most dairies, and it would probably end most vegan meals as well, because how do you go out and harvest crops out of a field when you go out and run that tractor through the fields to harvest all your vegan crops? You're going to end up killing a certain number of animals, and that makes you a criminal. So vegan stops as well. That means nobody's going to be eating much of anything if IP-28 passes in Oregon. Thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show. Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, The best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Mars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Well, the state of Washington just banned private home listings, and they've added penalties and new rules for how homes get sold. Now, is this about fairness or simply taking away control from both buyers and sellers and ceding it to the government? I thought we'd ask Michael Reeves about that. Michael is the founder and CEO of the Andy app, as in apps that you put on your phone or your computer. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, but for the life of me, I don't understand this. I mean, and I'll say, you know, I always try and disclose if I have a dog in the fight. Tina and I have owned a number of houses over the years, and there are times we've bought houses, we've sold houses. We're not flippers per se, but isn't it my business who I sell the house to? And why is it the government's business to tell me how I have to do that?
I mean, it's not, and that's my deal. Obviously, living in Texas, we're very pro-privacy, and so, you know, being a non-disclosure state, I don't even have to tell, you know, the state or the county what my house sold for. It's up to them to figure it out when they, you know, assess my home and tell me how much property taxes I should pay. Again, I just think it's a government overreach. If you look at that law that y'all passed, I think it was 48-0, I believe, if that was the count. I think it's government oversight. It's just more hands reaching, you know, into the cookie jar. And obviously, you know, that area is big on government control. And, you know, we have a little bit of that here in Texas. But again, I still think that, you know, if you want to sell it on a private market, you should be able to.
Well, in fact, they say the law prohibits real estate brokers from marketing a property to exclusive groups of brokers or prospective buyers unless the property is simultaneously marketed to the general public. So, Michael, I don't own a house in Texas, but I have friends who live in Texas. If somebody wants to come to you and says, Michael, I got a really special house here. I think you can market this to half a dozen people you know, and one of them is going to want to buy it, and I'm happy to have you do that. Ordinarily, somebody who's trying to sell something would try to sell it to the biggest group of people possible, because that generally means the, you know, greatest number of bidders and the highest price. But in some cases, you've got to have clients who say, no, I just want this sold to a very small group. And is there any reason to do it otherwise?
No, I mean, it's quick and easy, too. I mean, you know what it looks like when you go to sell a house. You put the for sale sign, you wait around, you got people, you know, running in and out of your house to look at it. You got to bake cookies every single time just to make sure the house smells good. It's like, I live on a golf course, and I'm not scoreboarding anybody, but when I sold my last house, I got a knock on the door and said, hey, I want to buy your house. I looked at my wife. I go, really? Okay. You know, we got X amount of equity, and we did it very cleanly and off to the races, and we're on to our next house. I mean, to be honest, I looked at her and I said, this is great. I mean, can we do this every single time? But unfortunately, there's some states that you know, want that government overreach and want to tell, you know, the buyer and the consumer what they can and can't do. And I don't know, man. I'm glad I live where I live and never leaving. They're trying to change some things about my state, but we're going to keep fighting.
It's funny, Michael, because right before the pandemic, we had this little teeny 900-square-foot house. And it wasn't, you know, it was nice. We'd fix it up okay, but it was tiny, and it was like 10 blocks from the beach. It was on the Oregon coast. And we said, well, let's go ahead and sell that one. And we said, okay, well, maybe put the money somewhere else. And there was a young lady that Tina knew who said, are you guys selling that place? And she said, yeah. And she said, could we buy it? And we said, well, if you, well, yeah, come up with a number, sure. And we decided, since we weren't using a you know, real estate agent, we just said it would have cost us this much with a real estate agent. We'll just split the savings. Everybody liked it. We've run into these people in the years since then, and they were happy with the arrangement. But it just seems like government wants to get involved. Is that part of what you tried to address by creating the Andy app?
Yes. I mean, here in Texas and obviously looking at Washington, right now we're a property tax protesting app in the state of Texas that uses AI to protest your property taxes all through a click of a button. We're the first and only on the Apple and Google Play Store. We're going to take this nationwide here soon. We start figuring out tax laws in other states, Florida, Georgia, even Washington State. But yeah, I think, again, in our state, we have really bad property taxes, and the county governments are telling you what your house is worth. And now, you know, 40 to 60% of Texans are overassessed, which means they're overtaxed. And only 5% of the population has, you know, argues it because they don't know what to do or where to turn. And now with my app, do a click of a button, we'll pull comps. They can upload pictures of the property. And then again, fair. What's fair, right? So my house shouldn't be compared with the guy down the street who just sold his. Heck, he baked cookies and he painted his house. You know, I got four kids and three dogs, and my house isn't worth what they're saying it's worth at this moment in time. And hey, you know, Texas being a non-disclosure state, which means they don't know what it actually sold for. They're just pulling an algorithm that I actually wrote a book called Tax by Algorithm. And so they're ultimately trying to tell you what your property is worth and compare it to others. And I'm not trying to sell my house right now, so I shouldn't have to pay that amount of property taxes because it's not worth that. Because I got holes in the walls and stains in the carpet and dogs have chewed through everything. So if you walk through my house right now, you're not buying it for top dollar. So anyway, we've got our own issues in Texas. But again, I still think that we have a system that, you know, everybody in the country should follow. And call me crazy, but, you know, why are people moving here at the drop of a hat? It's because our system works.
Well, I'm glad to see that you're going to automate the process, because I've gone through it one time, Michael. I had just bought a house, and it was an arm's length transaction, and I didn't know the people. And it'll tell you how long ago it was. It was $87,000 for the house. And the county came at me a week later, 1 week later, and said that house is worth $117,000. I said it did not increase in value $30,000 in 2 weeks. And they said, well, yes, it did, because our little algorithm, I don't think they call it an algorithm at the time. And they said, our calculations show it is worth $117,000. I said, well, I just bought it for $30,000 less. And we went at it. And at the end, they finally knuckled under and said, you're right. It is not worth what we said it was worth. And we tried to overcharge you by almost 30% for taxes. I'm glad to see the Andy app is out there to help people contest this kind of thing and tell the county, no, my property is not worth that much. That's Michael Reeves. Michael is the founder and CEO of the Andy app. And by the way, I've got no financial involvement in the Andy app, but I will tell you this. If the county ever tells you your property is worth a bunch of money and you say, no, it's not, I'd encourage you to go in and have at it. Tell them this is not going to be fair. You're going to either charge me the amount my house is actually worth, or we're going to have a fight that will go on until you make that something that is actually reasonable. I think that is the only way to get it done. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. You can find our X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And the question today, should ICE agents assist the TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? You know what? We just heard from Atlanta, where apparently ICE showed up to help out the TSA, and in a couple of hours, they had the wait time down to less than an hour. Sounds like the Democrats' little protest is not going to last very long. You've got the Lars Larson Show. If you're thinking...
Larson Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you about a brand new poll out, and it involves a case that was actually heard by the U.S. Supreme Court back in January, not so long ago. And in fact, it matches up perfectly with common sense, which makes me believe that liberals and Democrats are going to go absolutely nuts when the U.S. Supreme Court actually decides a case based on the law. But then it matches up with common sense. I think the Democrats this year have their hands full going to the voters in November and saying, please reelect us so that we can go ahead and, make a difference. Well, the problem is the difference that the Democrats are trying to make is one that is anti-American and it is anti-people. For example, the idea of transgender athletes competing in female sports. Now, it's generally not a problem if you have biological males who've decided to identify as females. They don't do very well at all. But the biological males who decide to compete as females, we've all seen the examples that belied all the arguments of the LGBTQ folks who said, nah, this is a small problem. It's really not going to affect that many people. And I told you my logical argument on that was, if you've got a man who's swimming as a woman against women, the man is going to win more often than the women are. Now, does that mean that women are always going to lose to a transgender woman who's actually a biological man? No, because, for example, if you go in and you compete as a swimmer and you weren't that good a swimmer to begin with, that's one thing. But consider the automatic advantage that biological males have over females. So when they went out, and this is done by the Center Square, they did their Center Square Voters Voice poll, and they found that 68%, this is more than two-thirds of all registered voters in America, support allowing the Supreme Court to uphold bans on transgender women competing in women's sports. So let me translate that. That is biological men who say they identify as women competing against women, that the ban on that is going to be supported by about two-thirds of all registered voters in the United States. They did the poll in the first week of March. They went out and they surveyed almost 2,700 respondents, including about 950 Republicans, about 930 Democrats, and almost 800 independents, of which 330 are what they call true independents. And when they did that, they found out 88% of Republican voters supported state bans on transgender women, meaning biological men, competing in women's sports. Now, when it came to the Democrats, this is where I think the numbers got interesting. It is just barely a plurality. 49% of Democrat voters supported the bans on transgender women. So even when you're told that on the left, they believe in this stuff, they don't. 49% of Democrat voters said, we want to ban transgender women from taking part in women's true women's sports. 49% of independent voters supported the transgender sports ban, and 65% of true independents. So it has overwhelming support. Well, back in January, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the arguments, and they were already skeptical about the idea of allowing men who identify as women to compete against women and girls in sports. They had heard challenges to laws in Idaho and West Virginia, and those laws said, if you're a biological man, you can't put on a dress, change your name, and compete against women. Currently, there are 27 states that have laws or restrictions that prevent transgender women from competing in true women and girls sports. So they are expected to issue a decision. It'll probably come in June or July of this year. Frankly, I wish they'd come out with it sooner, and I'll tell you why. Not just out of a desire that Americans should know how this one's going to turn out, but imagine all the young ladies out there who are right now competing in sports. This spring, there will be young ladies competing in sports involving things like track and field. They're going to be competing against young men who say they identify as women. Well, when they do that, in some cases, they're going to lose. And that means they may lose out on scholarships. They may lose out on opportunities. This is a decision that ought to be made right now. And then what they found when they looked at this survey done by the Center Square, they found a significant divide between age groups when it comes to support for transgender bans. Of 67% of respondents who were 18 to 29 supported a ban on transgender participation. 70% if it was above age 65 or so. Not a gigantic difference, but a sizable, but some difference at all. Adults aged 45 to 64 made up the smallest amount of support for state bans. So in other words, if you're in the middle ages, if you're very young, 18 to 29, you support the ban on transgender participation big time. If you're older, if you're above age 65, you are a big supporter, likely, of those transgender bans. It's only the one that are 45 to 64. Do you know what I think is happening there? I think there are an awful lot of men and women who are in that 45 to 64 age range. They go to work. They work around people who have a liberal point of view when it comes to transgender, who say, I don't see the problem. Why shouldn't we allow these biological males who are identifying as females to participate in sports? I think they're getting a lot of peer pressure. When they get above age 65 and they're no longer in the workplace, when they're a younger person, 18 to 29-year-olds support the ban on transgender participation in sports. It certainly makes sense to me. About 75% of male respondents supported a ban on transgender women in women's sports, and 62% of female respondents said the same thing. So there's actually more support from men in getting transgender out of sports competition than there is for women in getting transgender out of sports competition. Now, see if you think that makes sense, that women are apparently not willing to say, look, if we're going to compete as women, we should be able to compete against other women. We shouldn't have to compete against biological males. Biological males feel that way, but apparently women don't as much. In any case, it's a brand new survey. It's out from the Center Square, and I'm glad to put the results of it up on our website at LarsLarson.com. You want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism? It's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Talk, but want to be heard? Email Lars at talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist at Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, well, we put up a brand new poll question every day. Should ICE agents assist TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? I answered that one yes, and that was quite a number of hours ago. Do you know what we're already hearing from ICE and from the TSA? They apparently brought ICE agents into the Atlanta airport, and within a short period of time, just a few hours, they managed to get the wait time at the Atlanta airport, and that is one of the biggest airports in America. They've got the wait time now down below 1 hour. Now consider that. That's the result of Donald Trump thinking out of the box and saying, okay, the Democrats have decided they don't want to fund Homeland Security. They don't want to fund to be able to put the money behind TSA. Fine. We will find other people who will help TSA, and we will get the job done anyway. In any case, I ask you the question. My answer is a yes. Should ICE agents assist TSA in keeping passengers flying at America's airports? Today's X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to Christina. Hey, Christina, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I want to talk about IP-28 and the lesser-known verbiage in there about the rodents and the when it comes to artificially inseminating animals.
Yep, animal husbandry, yeah.
I was basically hearing a lot of chatter that if you artificial inseminate animals and you got caught, that you'd have to register as a sex offender.
I don't know whether they'd actually make you register as a sex offender, but it would be a criminal violation. They would make it a criminal violation if you, say you're a farmer, dairy farmer in Tillamook, where I went to high school, and you say, I'm going to have my cows impregnated with sperm from this bull on the other side of the country or on the other side of the Northwest. And so they get some semen, you know, they obtain it, it's frozen down, they put it in the cows, and you have just committed a non-consensual sexual assault on the cow, is the way IP 28 would look at it. You're not allowed to do that. Now, Christina, Right. Do you think that makes any sense at all?
No.
No.
I don't think the whole bill makes sense. And when the rodent thing comes through, all the people who are okay with the fishing and wildlife because they're vegan or vegetarian, when you got rodents coming into your house and you can't do anything about it, I think that's where they're going to start voting no.
Well, and how about rodents coming into your crops? Because think about this. If you're not allowed to use pesticides, herbicides, you're not allowed to, you know, catch rats, you're not allowed to deal with nutria, you're not allowed to deal with any of these other animals or the bugs. And you say, well, so you have to let the bugs eat up your crops? I mean, this is bad news for vegans, too, isn't it?
Right. You would think so.
I would think so. I mean, the whole thing seems crazy. And, Christine, they've tried two other runs of this, and they didn't get it on the ballot. This time, I believe they're close enough to get the signatures. They appear to be mathematically close enough to get it on the ballot. And it'd be really easy for somebody like me to say, that is so flippin' crazy. There's no way in the world even Oregonians are going to vote yes on that. Except that Oregon has voted yes on other crazy stuff, like legalization of hard drugs that passed by, I believe, 16 percentage points. And you say, no, you could never get that kind of thing past the voters. Well, it turns out you can't. That's where we're sitting right now.
Well, yeah, they vote them in, and then it becomes a problem after the fact. So by the time they vote something like this in, and there's rodents running rampant, people are starting to get, you know, viruses and illnesses from that, then they'll realize it's a problem after the fact.
Well, and imagine this, Christina. If you are somebody who has a dairy herd of cows and you're no longer allowed to breed those cows, I don't even know if you'd be allowed to necessarily harvest the milk. You can't harvest them as meat. And so you decide to liquidate your entire herd. And then a year or two later, it goes by and they say, well, we changed our mind. Do you think you're going to be able to get anybody back into the meat animal business 2 years later, when you decide you change your mind the way that people said we changed our mind on the hard drug legalization?
Right, and they can't even afford to, because by the time they've had to get a normal job, they can't afford to get back into it.
Nope, they're going to have to liquidate the entire herd, and it's going to be bad news for all of us. Christina, thanks for the call. Let's go to John in Lakewood. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Oh, yes, I heard you talking to the gentleman that invented the Andy app.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I'm not sure what that app's going to do for us. I do know that in Pierce County, Washington, where I live, to try to get your property value adjusted is like pulling teeth. The whole process is stacked against you because the presumption is that the board is right on everything, and you've got to come up with comps and overwhelming evidence to support your claim, and maybe they'll rule in your favor. But the next year, they're going to jack your value up or jack it down, however, and you're going to have to go through the whole process again. And I really believe that there should be an acquisition value-based method like Proposition 13 in California. And what that did was it based your valuation on what you paid at the time and allowed for a 1% increase in property tax. Over the time you owned it. And it preserved neighborhood stability, and it's a fairer system. But the way they do it everywhere else is just, it's shameful. It's a scam, you know?
Because I'll tell you, John, the one time I did contest what they said was my valuation, and it was a million years ago, I bought my first house for $87,500. And I bought it as an arm's length transaction. They weren't relatives of mine or friends of my parents or whatever. And then within 2 weeks, they raised the county said your value is $117,500. And I said,
I heard
way
you
in the world.
That earlier, Lars.
Yeah. And I just want to use it as an illustration, because all I had to do was show the county, this is an arm's length transaction. This is the actual amount I paid for the property, and they were forced to lower the valuation. Now, maybe they've changed their point of view since then, and they're a lot tougher on it, but I want us to have solid ways to beef whether or not a property is actually worth that much. John, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show.